You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. Coming up on our summer music series set list, we'll go behind the music with the Milwaukee rock band Midnight Reruns.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news of Wisconsin News Roundup.
A recent report shows Wisconsin continued to lag in job creation in 2015. We also learned this week that a state billionaire paid no income tax from 2012 to 2014. And state Democrats made some changes during their convention last weekend and are looking ahead to 2020.
Robert Menser joins us now for the latest on those stories. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So the latest jobs report came out this week. How does Wisconsin look compared to the rest of the country?
So not great. This is the sort of headline is Wisconsin is 36th in the nation for private sector job growth. The state created a little under 37,000 jobs last year, which is not terrific. This sort of mirrors a longer-term trend that, in general, Wisconsin has, like everywhere, the United States economy is growing, and Wisconsin's economy is growing too. Unemployment is pretty low, but the growth just isn't there in Wisconsin's economy. This is for 2015. This is like sort of the what is considered the gold standard. Governor Walker has referred to it as the gold standard in measuring these things, and it lags a bit. But it's a big giant survey of employers, and this really gives us a good picture of the economy in 2015.
So you mentioned a bit of a silver lining: unemployment numbers looking a little better. Unemployment's down, and also annual wage growth looking good. So how has the governor responded to this?
Yeah, so that's a good, that's a legitimate silver lining for sure. The fact is that our wage growth is higher than the national average by a fair amount. The national average for wage growth was 2.4%, and this found that wages in Wisconsin grew 3.1%, and the unemployment rate is fairly low. These are the types of numbers that Governor Walker wants to emphasize. Walker also likes to talk about the labor force participation rate, meaning how many, what share of Wisconsin's population is in the workforce, and it's higher than the national average. That is true. This report found the same. The only caveat to that is that that's sort of always been true in Wisconsin. That was true before the Great Recession. It was true during. It was true today. So it's not clear that measures a lot about sort of the forward momentum of the economy, but it is true. A lot of people work here.
Going to move on and talk about another story out this week about a Wisconsin billionaire in Beloit who paid no income tax between the years 2012 and 2014, evidently one of the richest women in the country. What can you tell us about that story?
Yeah, Diane Hendricks. She is a major conservative donor and a sort of a favorite target for Wisconsin liberals. She is worth about $5 billion, is the owner of a large roofing supply company, and she lives in Beloit. And she likes to spend money on politics. So she's been a big donor to Governor Walker's gubernatorial campaigns, as well as his presidential campaign. And she is, right now, the vice chairwoman of the Trump Victory Fundraising Committee in Wisconsin. But what she does not like to do is pay state income taxes, apparently. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found records or obtained some records showing that she paid zero in state income taxes for 2012, 2013, and 2014. Also paid zero in 2010, though 2011 somehow slipped through and she paid some state income taxes that year. So as you can imagine, yeah, she's a rich lady, and people don't like the idea that that rich people have sort of complicated taxes and don't have to pay the same share as you and me.
And what if her spokespeople had to say about that, about why that might be?
Well, so the truth is, rich people do have complicated taxes, and there are a lot of ways. It's actually not that unusual. There are a lot of ways that that through sort of complex accounting, they can take deductions or hold over losses. Like if her company lost a lot of money during the Great Recession, it's possible that that she's held over some income losses to sort of against current taxes. So I mean, it's incredibly complex. And then the other big point that her spokespeople make, or her spokesman made, is that they say that she paid like $7 million or $7.6 million in taxes in 2015. However, she got an extension on that. That wasn't verified, and so we don't know that to be the case. But this is apparently a thing that happens. You sort of pay, you know, she paid nothing, and now she's going to pay a whole bunch. So who knows?
As you said, she's very active in politics, and she has donated to Scott Walker. I know he's been asked, how do you think this looks to middle-class taxpayers? What has the governor had to say? Has he responded?
Yeah, I think he's not super enthusiastic about responding to this. There was a line in the story that a reporter said, "You don't want to touch this with a ten foot pole," and he said, "You got it." So I think that there's no question about it that it's not a politically advantageous discussion. But it's just a fact that she's a important person in Republican fundraising circles.
Interesting to see a couple Wisconsin women on this list of wealthy women in the country. Also, Epic's Judy Faulkner on this list as well.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Robert Menser right now. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, and it's the Wisconsin News Roundup. And Robert, the state Democrats held their convention in Brown County last weekend with eyes toward the future. What did Democrats decide to do about superdelegates? This was an issue on the table.
Yeah, so they want to do away with them. They voted to be against the use of superdelegates in the 2020 election. Wisconsin, of course, voted for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary, and this has been a favorite argument among a lot of Sanders supporters, that superdelegates are undemocratic, that it's a secretive system, privileges party insiders over people who actually vote in primaries. And all those things are absolutely true. That is exactly what they do. Now, you know, it's a political party. Political parties get to choose their own nominees through the rules that they set, and it's a fairly new concept, at least late 20th century concept, that that party nominees should be decided by a popular vote. But this is what we have now, and I think intuitively it makes sense, right? It feels like if the people vote, then that should be the nominee. So I would expect that Wisconsin will not be the only state to make such a recommendation, and it's entirely possible that the Democrats will actually make a change to the system.
So if that were to happen, do you know when that change might go into effect?
Well, I mean, it's not going to be this year, right? So I think that the goal would be to have a change for the presidential nominating contest in 2020, which seems like a impossibly long time away, right? But I guess these things come around.
And Rob, as we wrap up, the Democrats leadership are also looking at 2020 for possibly Democrats to take back the state legislature. Just briefly, what would the plan be there?
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, the main thing to notice is that Democrats seem really fired up about chances for this year's cycle. But the thing is, there's such a deficit. Democrats are solidly in the minority in the state. And so I think they see it as a process of a couple cycles before they would reasonably be able to retake a majority in the legislature.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Editor Robert Menser joining us to recap the biggest news stories from around the state this week. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Delete your account was the tweet heard around the world. We'll check out the tweet and the latest on a big week for the Hillary Clinton campaign. A lot of endorsements coming out this week and an appearance scheduled next week in Green Bay.
First, we continue to highlight Wisconsin culture in our summer music series set list. We've invited artists from all over the Midwest into the WPR studio for interviews and exclusive musical performances, which will air every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend.
Today, we feature the Milwaukee rock band Midnight Reruns. They recently stopped by the WPR studio to play songs from their latest record, Force of Nurture. And they talked about what it's like to record an album under the guidance of the bassist of the legendary band, The Replacements.
Mm-hmm.
Midnight Reruns, thanks a lot for coming up and playing in our studio for us today.
Thank you.
Well, Graham, let's start with the origin story. How did Midnight Reruns come together?
Me and Sam have been playing in bands together since we were really young. We were in middle school, and we knew Carl when we were in high school playing in punk bands. And then I met Brady in college, and we all kind of liked the same kind of stuff, and so we were in a band together.
Sam, what kind of stuff were you guys playing back in middle school?
Green Day covers.
This is how I met Sam.
My dad sells guitars.
Yeah, I was at a basketball tournament, like when I was 11 or 12 or something, and in between games, my dad took me to Guitar Center in Brookfield, and Sam's dad was working there, and I was like playing bass, and he's like, oh, my son's about your age, and he plays drums. And I was like, oh man, I've been looking for a drummer. I don't know anyone in my school. And he's like, oh, here, I'll give you his number so you guys can play together. And I was like, cool, like, what kind of stuff does he like? And Al was
here
like, he was like, oh, like, he likes Simple Plan a lot. And I was like, uh-oh, well, I'll call him anyways. But we both really liked Green Day a lot back then.
First day, we played Basket Case Green Day. That was like, we both knew it.
I knew that he was a drummer because he could play that fill in the beginning.
So this was your dad set up a play date, and that's how the band started.
It's literally, that's exactly
what
happened.
We owe it all to Al.
Yeah.
Alski.
You've got this new album, Force of Nurture. How's it different from your first album, first of all?
I like it better.
Good.
I got a delay pedal.
Yeah, it's definitely just all around better.
I think we like spent a little longer like in the songwriting than, you know, the first one. We had like a couple decent songs, and then we were really itching to record and do stuff, and so I wrote like a bunch in like a month just so we could go in to have enough for a full length. And this one we kind of spent a long time on all the songs, or at least a decent amount of time.
Well, let's talk about the recording here. Now, you guys, I understand, are big Replacements fans, and here you are, you're recording, or you, Graham,
I am.
We all are, but Graham more so than anyone.
Big time fan, okay. Yeah. And then Tommy Stinson, the bass player for the Replacements, well, he produced this album. So what was that like? You're rock god, more or less, one of them, and you're recording with him.
It was awesome. We didn't really have time to be like starstruck or anything, because we were only there for 4 days, so that's like not a super long time to make an album. So we were, and he kept like kind of ducking out to
go get him
back massage or like pick his daughter up from school or something. So we were like on a pretty big like time crunch. So I just kind of had to like put all like my starry eyes aside.
It was a good time out there though, in Hudson, New York, and I'd never been there. It's great, small town.
It's like close to Woodstock.
Yeah, it was good. We just did everything live for the most part.
Tommy Stinson bring a lot to what you did? Did he give you input, inspiration, or did he just hit record and you guys did what you do?
He had a lot of ideas for like, we played in Hudson like the night before we started recording, like right down the street from his house. So he kind of got an idea of what we were going to, we played all the new songs we were going to record.
Mm-hmm.
And so he kind of just wanted us to do that.
His whole like idea for production was to be like hands off at first, because he kind of just wanted us to sound like how we sound live. But then once we did all the basic tracks and like got into the overdubs, then he would be like, we would have like parts here and there where it would just be kind of a riff, and he'd be like, oh, that needs like a guitar solo over that. And I would be like, oh, I never thought of that. And then we did it, and song's like way better.
And then one song he was trying to tell us what he wanted, and we just told him to do it. So he actually plays.
There's a Tommy Stinson guitar part, uncredited.
Uncredited?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, he's credited now.
Here. He's credited.
Serotonin, thinking I'll never get out of.
want to go behind the music. Tell me about, so you had this four-day session. I hear the last night worked a little different. How'd it go? What happened?
The weed just
whiskey.
Got hammered.
And conspiracy theories and aliens and no idea what.
Yeah.
What else? Yeah, we were doing like percussion and guitar solos and stuff like that. So we were just like, you know, we didn't really party too much until the last day.
I mean, we kind of did.
We did, but I mean, the last day was. And it was fun. Tommy got really excited about like the tambourine. He was like yelling,
shouting about the
about tambourine because he liked the tambourine.
Yeah, part getting a up lot. And jumping in his chair. Got really mad when we suggested hand claps and part. Does not like those.
No hand claps.
Not
no,
a fan
no.
at all.
How much of that last night ended up actually on the album?
A lot of it.
A lot, yeah. Not all of it, but, you know, at the end of Great Southern Rail, this is like a long jam-out part, and I remember we spent a long time just, me and Carl just soloing over the whole thing, and in mixing we had to go back and, like, cut a lot of it out, because it was just, like, so ridiculous. Just, like, a 10-minute long, like, three guitar solos going at the same time. For the people on the radio, he's wearing two guitars at the
same
time.
We've got
time.
The drummer. I should set the scene here. Our drummer is wearing two guitars, and the guitarist is at the piano. Yeah, bass player wandering around.
Just now.
It's rock and roll chaos in Buck's studio here. Force of Nurture, is there any lyrical content, any themes that you had going through this album that this was about, Graham?
Yeah. A lot of it's just, like, about myself and anxiety type of things that I deal with mentally. Not all of them, though. Great Southern Rail is just about a movie that I watched, and then I wrote the lyrics in, like, 10 minutes after I watched it.
I've talked to some songwriters in here lately who say, you know, they're writing about how they're feeling now, but it's also they're writing to deal with how they're feeling now. Is that part? I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it's your personal therapy, but is there a little bit
of
that?
Yeah, I mean, it is, too. You know, some people, like, go to the gym, and some people, like, go to therapy, and, like, you know, I, like, do music stuff, and it makes me feel better about myself, I guess.
I understand you guys opened up for the Replacements after this was recorded. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And this is a big crowd. Thousands of people. I don't know. I don't know if you're usually playing for thousands of people. If not, that's a big transition.
Absolutely
maybe.
Not.
What was that like?
It was okay.
It was okay. I mean, does it feel different to be in front of a crowd that size?
It didn't for me really. It was just like, well, this is like happening. Yeah. Like, you know, if this is like what we want to do, then it shouldn't really matter.
Sure. Well, and also, if the lights are bright enough, you can't tell how many people are out there.
Well, yeah, you can't see past the third row anyway.
Yeah, it was like right before we went on, I was pretty nervous. I don't know about the rest of you guys. But once we started doing it, it was like, okay, we're in the zone.
It was very surreal, though, for me.
Let's talk about live shows. How much are you guys touring now that the album is out?
We did 2 3-week tours. We're taking a break right now to work on new record.
There's one in the works.
Yeah, where are you on a new... That's pretty quick turnaround. You just did this one in October.
Well,
you've got another one going now?
Yeah, that's because we recorded Force of Nurture in 2014. And so it took a year to come out after we recorded it. So that whole year... I was working on stuff, And so by the time it was out, we already had like almost a whole new album written.
So it sounds like you guys have a pretty constant supply of new material coming in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always writing songs, and we got a practice space that's like pretty close to all of our houses, and we practice every week, and it gets boring playing the same ones over and over again, you know?
What's it like, Milwaukee? You're based there. What, Sam? What's Milwaukee like as a musical home for you guys?
It's awesome. Yeah, there's a lot of cool bands.
There's like cool shows usually every weekend,
and it's
sometimes it's like too many where you can't can't keep up.
You gotta choose. You gotta nix some. But it's not always like that. But like a lot of times it is, which is awesome.
I don't know if like a lot, you know, Milwaukee's really known to be like a really cool music city. By other cities, I have not. Maybe it is, but it is. I'm putting it on the record right now.
Is it?
It is.
It is.
It is. All right, well, I'll let you guys get back to playing some more songs for us. Thanks a lot for joining us up here and playing in the studio.
Thanks, Rob.
That was the Milwaukee rock band Midnight Reruns. You can catch them live June 24th at the Majestic Theater in Madison.
Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to WPR.org/setlist.
Coming up, we'll talk about the endorsements coming in for Hillary Clinton and what's ahead for the candidate and the campaign. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7, Ken Rudin is back with this week's edition of Political Junkie. Tonight, President Obama, Clinton, Sanders, Warren, and more in a big week on the Democratic side of the presidential race. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, Hillary Clinton has secured enough delegates to make her the presumptive Democratic nominee.
Since she clinched the delegate count, she's begun racking up endorsements from some pretty big names like President Obama and Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Now there's a lot of talk about those endorsements, potential vice presidential picks, and taking swipes at Donald Trump on Twitter. She'll also kick off her general election campaign here in Wisconsin next week. More on that a bit later.
And we want to hear from you on this. Were you surprised by the endorsements? How do you see the campaign shaping up? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Joanne Bamberger. She's been following Hillary Clinton's career. She's a political journalist and the author and editor of Love Her, Love Her Not, The Hillary Paradox. Joanne, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Hillary Clinton, the presumptive nominee, not official, of course, till the convention. But here's a listen to President Obama officially throwing his support now behind Hillary Clinton.
For more than a year now, across thousands of miles in all 50 states, tens of millions of Americans have made their voices heard. Today, I just want to add mine. I want to congratulate Hillary Clinton on making history as the presumptive Democratic nominee for President of the United States. Look, I know how hard this job can be. That's why I know Hillary will be so good at it. In fact, I don't think there's ever been someone so qualified to hold this office. She's got the courage, the compassion, and the heart to get the job done. And I say that as somebody who had to debate her more than 20 times.
President Obama there endorsing Hillary Clinton officially. So, Joanne, the question coming out of the primary has been, if it's Hillary Clinton, will Democrats who supported Bernie Sanders end up uniting around Hillary Clinton? From what you're seeing this week, that effort from President Obama, do you think that's going to happen?
You know, if you had asked me that question last week, I would have had a different answer. But my answer today is, I think, yes, that will absolutely happen. Two reasons. You saw the president have his meeting with Senator Sanders Vice President Biden meeting with him, really talking with him to give him the respect that he's due, but also, I think, really talking with him about where we need to go given the electoral landscape right now. And when you look back at 2008, I remember very well I was a Hillary Clinton supporter then. And, you know, there were so-called, you know, PUMAs, Party Unity My, AFFs, supporters who said at this time in the campaign that they would never support Barack Obama. And, of course, that happened. And so I think given what's at stake, given who is running on the Republican side, I think those supporters of Bernie Sanders will, in the next couple of months, come around to support Hillary.
Now, you've looked a lot at Hillary Clinton's career, this new book. You're looking at people's attitudes toward Hillary Clinton. Some people, obviously, big fans. She's generated a lot of negative ratings from conservatives on the one hand, from liberals on the Democratic Party side or affiliated with the Democratic Party on the other. Why do you think she has this strong, maybe not quite lover or hater paradox, but why this strong division of feeling?
A couple of reasons that I found sort of putting this together and talking to so many women and having them contribute. I think first we've known Hillary Clinton for so long that it's hard not to have strong feelings about her in the way that we have strong feelings about many other politicians we've seen for a long time. And, you know, not that Bernie Sanders hasn't been around for a long time, but in terms of a national presence, he's somewhat new. So is Donald Trump. We haven't had a chance to really parse them as much as we have with Hillary. And I think, for better or worse, when you have women candidates, they're held to a much different standard among men and women. And especially when women look at her, they want her to be perfect in all ways, whatever that definition of perfection means to them. And as I'm sure you can guess, you know, no one can live up to that sort of standard where, you know, everyone wants her to be perfect. And I think that's where some of our criticism comes in. We've waited so long to see someone, a woman who could truly take the White House, and so we sort of want her to be everything. And when she's not, that's somewhat disappointing.
One concern that people have had, both the Republican critics and Bernie Sanders supporters, is kind of the, I guess, the establishment side of Hillary Clinton. People see this exemplified in her attitude toward the email story that's been going on. A new story coming out today, a fundraiser, a supporter for Hillary Clinton, getting an appointment for an International Security Advisory Board when she was Secretary of State. This idea that she's an establishment figure, she's connected to big money people and in an anti-establishment mood. What do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, with very few exceptions, almost everyone in the political world who has been around long enough to have experience has, for lack of a better term, establishment connections, or they have some establishment reputation. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You want someone who's been around for a long time, who has a lot of experience. I mean, she could certainly hit the ground running in a way no other candidate could in terms of foreign policy and relationships with foreign leaders. But in terms of part of the establishment criticism, I say there's nothing less establishment than having a woman president. We've only ever had men presidents. So on a certain level, that's very not establishment.
Talking to Joanne Bamberger, author of and editor of Love Her, Love Her Not, The Hillary Paradox, about a big week in the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Anne on the line in Milwaukee. Anne, hi.
Hi. I seem to be living in a different reality from your guest. I don't think that women are demanding perfection of candidates, but they certainly should demand a lack of corruption and corruption over a long time. In addition, you know, the news media seem to have called California when 2.5 million votes remain uncounted in California, as reported by the Los Angeles Times. Many of these are provisional ballots that, again, with the voter suppression that's occurred throughout this primary season, new voters were frequently given provisional ballots when they should have been given crossover ballots that would have been counted immediately. And L.A. County alone has 240,000 provisional ballots. That's just L.A. County.
Gotcha, Anne. I take your points there. And Joanne, a couple common themes we've heard, especially from supporters of Bernie Sanders, that Hillary Clinton is corrupt, that the Democratic primary was the thumbs were on the scales in Hillary Clinton's favor, and that we in the media have been too quick to anoint Hillary Clinton. A lot there, but what do you make of that, Joanne?
Right. Well, I certainly, you know, can't speak to whether the media did or did not call California too early. I know that there are, you know, some issues with the voting, and, you know, I am not in that world of the media, so, you know, I understand that there are issues with that. But in terms of quote-unquote corruption, I have to say that there have been so many instances, so much of this is driven by GOP rhetoric from the Bill Clinton era, when people were trying to pin things on them like Whitewater and Travelgate and all these other gates, and nothing ever came of those. You know, there was never anything proven in terms of any corruption, yet this aura still remains around her because her opponents really still push those ideas. You know, there really hasn't been anything proven against her in terms of any corruption. I know everybody, you know, has their concerns about, you know, the Benghazi hearings and her ties to Wall Street. You know, when we talk about those things, especially Wall Street, we have to look at the ties that pretty much every other candidate on both sides of the political aisle, with the exception of Bernie Sanders, have had over the past years. Barack Obama has had a lot, other Republicans have had, and I'm not saying that's a good thing. But I think it would be a good idea to let's hold everyone to the same standard and not hold her to a higher standard.
And thanks for that call. We'll go next to Troy in Milwaukee. Troy, hi.
Hello. I would just like to say that I'm a Bernie's supporter, and I was hoping Bernie would be the president. I am switched. I will support Hillary, but I do want to point out one strategy, which I don't know why they're not doing this. If they want to defeat Trump, what people need to realize is Hillary needs to bring Sanders aboard and put him in charge of trade deals, because a lot of people that are going for Trump, it's over the jobs issue, and they need to expose Trump for one thing, and that is he is going to negotiate those trade deals, but they're going to benefit the capitalists. They're going to benefit the business owners. Sanders is going to negotiate trade deals that are going to benefit unions and labor.
Troy, thanks a lot for the call. Just a few moments left with our guest, Joanne. The idea of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have had some success talking about trade. Is there a lesson there for the Hillary Clinton campaign?
I think it's something that she definitely has to pay attention to. I mean, given the support for Bernie Sanders and the excitement for him, especially around these issues, I am sure she is not going to ignore that. I mean, the AFL-CIO came out and endorsed her today, which is great, but I'm sure that she is not going to let this important issue go. And I know they had a really hard battle between Clinton and Sanders, but I think now that it seems that Hillary will be the nominee, that the Democrats are obviously circling the wagons, coming together, and I am sure they are going to use Senator Sanders in that role and whatever other roles they think would be good for them.
Joanne, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Joanne Bamberger, political journalist, author and editor of Love Her, Love Her Not, The Hillary Paradox. She joins us to talk about the presumptive Democratic nominee. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We've been talking about Hillary Clinton securing enough delegates to become the presumptive presidential nominee of the Democratic Party.
And she'll kick off her campaign for the general election close to home here next week with President Obama in Green Bay.
And we want to hear from you on this. What do you think about her decision to campaign with the president in Wisconsin? Do you see the state as a battleground and why? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mike Wagner joins us now, Associate Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks.
So I know you aren't sitting in on the strategy meetings, but why start this campaign, in effect, Hillary Clinton and President Obama here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think a few reasons. We tend to think of Wisconsin as a swing state, even though Wisconsin has gone with a Democrat in every election from 1988 forward. But it's usually a fairly hotly contested race. It's the home of the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who was the vice presidential candidate last time. And so there are reasons that Wisconsin itself is strategically important. Wisconsin was a state that did not go Trump in the Republican primary, and so it's a good place to start in that regard. And starting in Green Bay, I think, is smart because the kind of the prevailing view right now is that, you know, Madison and Milwaukee are pretty solid for Clinton in this race, but it's the rest of the state where the Democrats hope to make some gains, both at the state legislative level and, of course, at the presidential level. If Hillary Clinton wants to win Wisconsin, doing better in outstate Wisconsin is a way to help make that far more likely.
Given that Democrats have been winning in Wisconsin for a long time in presidential races, and that, I mean, this was really ground zero of the Never Trump movement. A lot of conservatives in the state still are not on the Trump train. Is this maybe a slam dunk for a Democrat this year? Are they wasting their time in Wisconsin, or do you think it really legitimately is a battleground?
I think that it's a battleground because the candidates will treat it like it's a battleground, which means that we'll be one of the few states that will see lots and lots of negative television ads for the last, you know, several months before Election Day. And so the candidates will treat it that way. And in many ways, it is a legitimate battleground state because you have, you know, a Republican governor who's won several re-elections right here in this state. You have a strong majority Republican Assembly and State Senate, and you have Speaker Ryan from here, Reince Priebus of the Republican Party, you know, also, you know, from Wisconsin. So this is a place Democrats really feel like they need to win this. And if they're winning Wisconsin, it's likely they're going to be winning lots of the other swing states they want to win in the fall.
I want to bring in a caller. We've got Ethan on the line in Waupun. Ethan, hi.
Hey there. How's it going?
Good. What do you think?
So earlier, there was a remark that the individuals who said that they would not support Obama, that eventually they did come over. Just want to remind people that back in 2008, Hillary supporters were already Democrats. This time around, she's trying to get the independents to switch over to Democrats, where many of them aren't really Democrats or even liberal.
Ethan, thanks for the call. So that could be a tall order for Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin in particular. Mike, Wisconsin is a state that went for Bernie Sanders in the primaries. What would Hillary Clinton have to do to win Democrats, the liberals who supported Sanders, and independents who voted for Bernie Sanders?
Well, first, it's hard to imagine someone who likes both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump on the issues. It could be there are some people who just say, you know what, I'm just tired of career politicians, and even though Sanders was actually a Washington politician for longer than Hillary Clinton was, you know, he has certently the sense that he's a political outsider, and, you know, having only identified as a Democrat officially in the last year is an example of that. And so it could be that some people might like both Sanders and Trump because they're outsiders, but most people who like Sanders agree with him on a variety of issues, or at least some of the most important issues dealing with economic inequality, trade, and wanting a greater say in government. And so Donald Trump is not, you know, the clear choice for voters who have those particular policy views. And the other thing that is worth thinking about here is that while a lot of people tell pollsters they are independent and tell themselves even that they are independent, most people tend to vote in highly partisan ways. And people who say they're independents but are willing to admit that they lean one way or the other typically engage in higher levels of partisan voting than people who just admit right off the bat that they're a Republican or a Democrat.
Ethan, thanks for the call. As we start to wrap up, Mike, a lot of times the incumbent party from the White House is wondering if their incumbent president is an asset or a liability to the campaign. Seems like President Obama is all in campaigning for Hillary Clinton, campaigning with Hillary Clinton. Is he going to help her?
I think they'll deploy him in places where he is popular. We'll probably see him in places in states that he won that Democrats hadn't been typically winning over the past few cycles, like Virginia, for example. We'll probably see him campaign there. We'll see him in other states out west where he is popular as well. His approval rating overall is going up. The economy is growing, and typically when those things are happening, the incumbent president is more of an asset than a liability. But make no mistake, Barack Obama is not popular in some quarters of the country, and it's not at all likely that Hillary Clinton's campaign would send him to campaign in those places.
Mike, thanks as always for checking in with us.
My pleasure.
That's Mike Wagner. He's an associate professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at Hillary Clinton's campaign, along with President Obama campaigning on her behalf, and they're scheduled to come to Green Bay next week.
In 2015, nearly 100,000 payday loans were made in Wisconsin. Consumers are often faced with triple-digit interest rates on these short-term, often small-dollar transactions.
The power to set a maximum interest rate on these loans lies with the states. But as Bridget Bowden reports, lawmakers in Wisconsin may not be getting a full picture of what's happening with payday loans.
In 2014, Michelle Warney went to a payday loan store in Green Bay and took out a few hundred dollars.
I was starving to death. I mean, I literally was. I had no food in the house at all.
Eventually, she paid this off. But then she took a second loan and then borrowed even more to pay that one off. Right now, Warney will end up paying more than $1,700 on her $740 loan. That's an interest rate of 143%. And as high as that rate might seem to some people, average interest on payday loans last year in Wisconsin was nearly four times as high, 564%, according to the State Department of Financial Institutions. Wisconsin is one of only eight states with no limit on payday loan interest. But Warney's loan isn't technically a payday loan. In 2011, Republican lawmakers and Governor Scott Walker changed the definition of payday loan to only include loans for 90 days or less. Anything longer, like Warney's loan, is not subject to state payday loan laws.
If you go to a payday loan store, there's a sign in the window that says payday loans. But the reality is, if you need, you know, more than $200 or $250, they're going to steer you to what really is an installment loan.
That's State Representative Gordon Hintz from Oshkosh. He says interest on these installment loans can really pile up because they last longer. And even though the official numbers of payday loans have been going down since the definition changed, he says installment loans have become more popular. But they aren't included in the annual report given to the state legislature. Former DFI Secretary Peter Bildstein says that's a problem.
The data that we have to gather at DFI and then report on an annual basis to the legislature is almost inconsequential.
A DFI spokesperson confirmed in an email that the annual report doesn't include loans that aren't technically payday loans. Earlier this month, the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau proposed new rules for payday loans. They would require certain lenders to verify that people can actually pay their loans back in hopes that consumers won't get stuck in a cycle of debt. But Representative Hintz says these rules won't address installment loans, and in fact could even drive people toward them.
Knowing the industry, my guess is we're going to see more products morph into more dangerous, more high-cost, long-term loans.
The payday loan industry is also critical of the proposed rules, but for different reasons. Darren Anderson is CEO of QC Holdings, which operates seven quick cash stores in Wisconsin and many others nationwide. He says the regulations will leave people who need emergency cash with no options.
Consumers need more credit options. They don't need fewer.
And that's one thing consumer advocates and payday lenders agree on. Consumers need fast access to small amounts of credit. Here's Barbara Sella from the Wisconsin Catholic Conference.
In this sense, the payday lenders are correct that they're filling a need. People are in need of credit.
But she says alternative solutions from nonprofits or credit unions would be better than payday loans.
But I think that we could come up with organizations that are not making money off of this and that are, you know, taking any profit and reinvesting it.
For now, Warney says she has no way to pay off her loan. She's made one payment, but has no plans to pay anymore.
No, I'm not anymore. What can they do to me?
And she says she'll never borrow from a payday lender again. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.